I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. This week, I heard two news stories that seemed a bit at odds with each other, frankly. The first story was about some future need to grow food in space. You know, for colonization. And if you're going to have food up there, you either have a whole lot of food miles, or you grow it there, or produce it there. Now, the other story was from the journal Scientific American, and this story said that farmers here on Earth who follow principles of what they call agroecology are able to achieve greater food security, higher incomes, and better health. Put these two stories together, and you can easily deduce that people who want to have success in producing food up in space, they might just learn a little bit from people who have had successful food production down here on Earth. But I'm not going to space, and quite likely neither will you, so food generated here on Earth is just fine by me. Meanwhile, down here on Earth, there is an endless array of approaches and methods to food production, and there is more controversy and more impassioned discussion about it than most people realize when they head out to the grocery store. We are now going to meet somebody who falls into the category of those farmers who advocate for a green sort of farming that departs from the 20th century's dependence on big farms and industrial approaches. I am already very well disposed to him for that reason alone. But you could also just fall in love with the farm and sheep pictures that he posts on Twitter, where he has over 150,000 followers. James Rebanks grew up on a family farm in England's idyllic Lake District. Hardly seems the place for giant tractors, pesticides, chemical fertilizers. He's well known for his books, The Shepherd's Life and Pastoral Song, A Farmer's Journey. He joins with us now, James Rebanks. Welcome to Constant Wonder.
Hi, thanks for that introduction.
James, I live in the drought-stricken American West, and so I have water on my mind all the time. I'm wondering if our conversation could begin with water, because I think it's a great concern to you also, but for kind of different reasons.
Yeah, so they, we arguably have too much water, or have had historically. So we live in a place with very high rainfall, and the accepted wisdom for many centuries has been that the wise thing to do is to drain your fields and get the water off your fields as quickly as possible. Down the rivers to the sea, because there'll be plenty more rain behind it. And that's been an assumption that's had some value for most of history. But we're now starting to get, it looks like we're starting to get different weather. We're starting to get just a much longer drought periods, and we're getting much more extreme amounts of rain than we ever have had before. And that's leading to a lot of soul searching here about whether we're set up for the kind of weather that we're going to get. And our relationship with water. And yeah, I'm a passionate believer in having healthy soil. And yeah, it turns out that one of the best ways to slow down the water on your land, hold more water on your land in a good way, not in a sodden ground way, is by having healthy aerated soil. And there's lots of other reasons I'm sure we'll come on to for why that's a good thing. But yeah, it turns out if we want to stop the city downstream from me flooding, one of the best things I can do is to have healthy soil that holds water. In its structure.
So this leads to a concern for what is unhealthy soil, and how did unhealthy soils come about in the region where you live?
Yeah, so I mean, probably the best place to start with this is that nobody understands soil really until about 20 years ago, maybe 10 years ago. The science on how soil works, what soil is changing massively by the week. Like anybody listening to this program that's into soil will know this. So for most of human history, we thought that soil was just effectively dirt. Most of the people for most of human history have been fed by annual crops that were grown by plowing. So you basically cut the ground apart, you turn it over with a plowshare, and that's your seedbed for growing the things that you eat. And most humans are still eating things grown in that way. We now know that's problematic, and that would have blown my grandfather's mind. My grandfather died 30 years ago. He didn't have a clue about that. My dad died 6 years ago, and I don't think he knew much about that. But the soil is now really, really clear. The less we disturb the soil, the more that we feed it with organic matter, the more that we can use soil to grow the things that we need, but without damaging it and degrading it, the better. And it turns out that the whole post-war industrial agriculture movement was based on the idea that soil was effectively dirt. You could rip it to bits with a plow multiple times. You could then put back the nutrients that were leaching out of it using fossil fuel fertilizers, things like sort of ammonia, nitrate, and other things. And it turns out that that's wrong, actually. We need to get away from that model, and we need to get back to a model where we're looking after soil in a way that nature understands, can repair itself with living plants and the soil microbiology. Instead of being torn apart and made too hot and too dry, it's kept nice and warm and moist where it should be.
So, James, I heard you say that your grandfather and your father would be surprised that you might be inclined to dispense with the plow and the tilling of soil and those sort of things, and that there's a new soil science. But you also said we need to get back to the way nature does it. I think that in there, it's really important to understand that you are not advocating for returning to traditional human agrarian practices of soil tillage and fallow fields and the way it was maybe 100, 200, 300 years ago.
It's slightly more complicated than that. So in the landscape where I live, which is, we live on a hill farm, which is basically high up. It's a pastoral system with grazing. So here, lots of the answers actually are a combination of old practices and things that people knew a century ago. But there are also some new tweaks. I'll talk about the tweaks in a moment. But also in the landscapes where we do need to grow annual crops, grains, wheats, corn, those things, soy. What I'm advocating is what most soil scientists are advocating, which is that we need to get back to something we used to know about, which is rotational farming. And we also need to have what we would call mixed farming in the UK, which is if you have a rotation of different crops in successive years, and part of that rotational cycle over 3, 4, 5 years is a grazing cycle with green photosynthetic plants, which you're then grazing with cattle and sheep and other things, then that photosynthetic green crop stage or cover crop stage is basically repairing the soil for you. So what we now know is that even if we have to grow those annual crops to feed ourselves, we can't do the same crop repeatedly and just try and get away with that by using pesticides to control the weeds and using fossil fuel nutrients to make up for the fact that the soil's becoming depleted. And I know that's quite complicated, but basically what repairs soil is plants. Plant roots and the photosynthesis of taking the sugars and the carbon from the sunlight, taking them down into the soil and feeding the soil microbiology. And yeah, so if you can have part of your farmland in a rotational cycle where you have green plants and then you use those green plants with sheep and cattle, which is something that my great-grandfather or great-grandmother would have known and which we forgot after the Second World War because we got new cheating technologies, then we can do the things that we need to do, but we can also keep soil healthy. It's a little bit of going back to things we knew in the past, but it's also doing those things much better because we have new science that tells us how to do it.
Well, I'm thinking now about old biblical passages about using dung. This whole idea of the integration of animals in the whole rotation is important too. It's not just a matter of the plants doing the work. Yes, the roots and the sugars, and I've heard that story before. It's good, but don't you also rely on those grazing animals to do their defecation?
Yeah, this whole movement, and I'm not really part of a movement. I'm just a farmer getting on with looking after his land and his animals. But this whole movement called regenerative agriculture, which is about mending soil and making it healthy again, and mending ecosystems. A lot of the leading thinkers on this around the world, and some of them are in America, have realized that the best way to repair soil that's been depleted by overplowing, repeated plowing, and growing the same crops again and again, is to get back a diversity of plants. The greatest possible diversity is a good thing. So if you think about the American Midwest, for example, that was prairie. Prairie used to have all of these different flowers and grasses. They all have different roots. They all put different things into the soil. So getting some of that diversity back on the surface is how you mend the soil. And of course, we can't eat grasses, and there are a heck of a lot of us, let's be honest. So what do we do in that part of the agricultural cycle to produce something profitable and productive that we can eat? Well, livestock are the obvious solution. And, you know, that's why people many of the most sustainable, most long-established farming systems on Earth included livestock, because they can be part of that cycle which works.
Do you view your farm, and I'm going to ask you about your grandfather here in just a second, a little bit more, but do you view your farm as something separate, distinctly separate from what we traditionally call nature out there, the wild? Or do you kind of see some interplay between the two, or overlap, or how does that work for you?
Okay, so I was encouraged as a young, I'm 47 years old now, but when I was young, all of the conventional thinking about agriculture was to think about your fields effectively like they're a factory floor, right? You think about the inputs. How do you minimize the cost of the inputs? How do you maximize the outputs? How do you make it more efficient by using bigger machinery? All of that was kind of pretending that this wasn't a natural space. It wasn't part of an ecosystem. And what we've now learned is that that's a game that only works for a while. Then you begin to run out of it begins to stop being successful. So weeds work out how to beat pesticides. Repeated plowing leads to soil degradation and soil erosion. So what we're having to do, and I'm having to do it on my farm, and farmers all around the world are having to do it, is to start thinking of their farm as both as an ecosystem itself, but as part of a bigger ecosystem. And it's never a factory floor. You may have to do economic things there to earn a living, to pay your bills, to feed your community. That's all true. But there's certain things that happened in that place before we got there as humans. And those things are what the native insects, birds, mammals, the whole range of flora and fauna, they need those things to be there. So this idea that we can think about a field or a farm or a farming landscape as some kind of economic unit like a factory is just deeply, deeply misguided. It isn't going to work. It isn't going to feed us in the long run. It's a poor piece of thinking where we've applied a sort of reductive kind of economics to something that's actually really complex and natural and relies on diversity and natural processes. So yeah, when I think about my farm now, yes, I have the same concerns as my father and my grandfather, which is how do I produce a bunch of things to sell to pay my bills? And that's not easy, even when you're doing the right thing. But I'm also thinking, okay, what are the native habitats that things need here? And what are the natural processes? And how might my food production and my business use those things or fit into them or accommodate them around the edges? There's all sorts of ways of doing that. So yeah, a farm is an ecosystem. It's not a factory floor. And it never was. We just got away with thinking it was for a while because we had some amazing technologies.
You write that your grandfather would have preferred and did prefer being on foot to survey his farm rather than being on the back of a tractor. It probably wasn't just about the noise of the tractor.
Yeah, well, he was a sensible enough man to know that there was less staff on the farms, and of course you needed to do some things mechanically with a tractor. But he was an old enough man to have worked with horses, to have plowed with horses and harrowed with them and done other field work. And I can remember, like, the first part of my book, Pastoral Song, is about the year that my grandfather decided to take me under his wing and teach me about farming. And he took me to the fields. But his stories were all about the things he'd learned by walking behind a horse on the land. And he would tell me that particularly the young men, when they got onto tractors and they turned the radio on and the air conditioning on, were missing out on a whole kind of education that you got by walking behind a horse, by having the dirt on your feet, by being closer to the ground, by seeing whether there's worms or not. That when you were raised up, whatever it is, 6 or 8 feet from the ground and there's a radio on and there's air conditioning and you're going at 20-something miles an hour, that's a different relationship. And he thought people were losing their field knowledge and their field skills and their ability to see things. And it's really interesting when you look at the great, great regenerative farmers around the world now, a lot of it is about getting back closer to the ground, closer to nature, closer to using your hands more, observing more, being much, much, much more observant about what's actually happening, not trying to bludgeon everything into a simpler model using just another bigger machine or the latest chemical to zap it. We've got to be way smarter than that. Those things aren't going to work for much longer anyway. I mean, sort of pesticides are failing everywhere now. Black grass and other things aren't killed by it. Antibiotics are starting to fail because we've abused and misused them for so long. And Yeah, and as we say, repeated plowing, growing the same monocultures of crops has led to soil degradation and soil loss at unsustainable levels. So the post-Second World War things is slowly dying around us. There's no choice. We have to change. We have to get our head around a more holistic way of looking at these things and be much cleverer about how we exist within nature.
From your book, Pastoral Song, it's quite clear the affection you have for your grandfather and those walks and the learning from him. You tell the story of the curlew nest and him moving that out of the way, preserving the eggs. That's the kind of thing you wouldn't have to move these days, I'm imagining, as you walk around, if you spy one of those. Because if you're not plowing and not disturbing, can you just leave that? Have you had an experience like that of your grandfather's?
Yeah, so I told the story basically about my grandfather spending his whole time watching the birds and other things that while he's working. So he's not stopping like a bird watcher or something. He's just literally while he's working. And the really exciting thing is, as we've begun to restore our farm by putting back in the old-fashioned thorny hedgerows, by putting back the diversity of plants into our meadows and grazing them with these long periods for rest and recovery so that they can seed and flower, our farm is filling up once more with all of the birds that have vanished from modern farmland. So I think it's true in America. It's true in Britain. We've lost something like 60% of our farmland birds in the last 30 or 40 years. There's an insect apocalypse happening everywhere around us at the moment where they're just disappearing, including key pollinators that pollinate the crops that keep us alive. So to see that you can turn this around, that someone is as bang average and as moderate, somebody with as moderate intelligence as myself can look after a farm differently and can mend it, and we can just simple changes can put back the diversity, can put back the abundance of insects and birds and other things. That's really exciting. And everybody in my family and many of my neighbors are excited by that as well. It takes farmers from being the bad guys and the villains in a story about loss to being our best friends and allies for putting things back together. And that's what farmers can be. And I know a lot of American farmers are really stuck because of debt and other things in a commodity producing system. But everywhere I travel around the world now talking about my books, I get huge audiences, and many of them are farming people, and they come to me and they say, we know this is true. We knew this ourselves in our heart of hearts. We've seen these changes, and they don't want to be the bad guys. They've got themselves trapped in this sort of structural system, which the rest of us are partly culpable for. We don't want to think about farming enough. We don't want to think about food enough. We just want it easy. We want it cheap. We want to go to the supermarket. And we've stepped away from things that we're responsible for. We literally think it's none of our jobs to worry about those things. And it actually is. It's not just the farmers. It's the consumer, the shopkeeper, the economist, the politician. It's actually on all of us to create systems where a farmer can do the right things and make a living and feed as well. We have to do all of those things. It never was a factory. It really isn't a factory now. We need to change.
James Rebanks with us. He's author of Pastoral Song, A Farmer's Journey, and he runs a family-owned farm in England's Lake District, a farm that's been in the family for generations now. James, I'm curious to know if, as you walk your farm, and obviously, probably just like your grandfather, you don't have the luxury of just kind of romantically being out there and feeling the breezes and just basking in the glory of it all. You got your work to do. But you do walk your farm and inspect it, don't you?
Yeah. There is a saying in British farming that the best form of fertilizer is the farmer's feet. And what that funny expression is the best farmers walk their land. The best farmers are watching how the grass is growing in the different places, how the crops are changing, about how they're, whether the grazing's gone too far or whether it's time to move on, whether the grasses have seeded yet or not. So we don't walk around it like a poet. We're walking around it to get work done, to move sheep from A to B, to move cattle from one pasture to the next. Most days I make an effort to walk across at least some of our land and to try and be a much closer observer of it and to understand our place in it and to try and understand when I'm doing harm and when I'm perhaps doing good. And to try and understand these things. I mean, One of the things about this is it requires much more learning and much more knowledge on the part of the farmer. So the minute you accept that you're part of an ecosystem, you have to become a sort of amateur ecologist. You've got to start paying attention to butterflies and birds and wild plants. And far from that being a pain, what we're actually finding in my community is that the farmers like that. They know that they're on the wrong end of a really bad beating if you go down this industrial agriculture model. It doesn't need those farmers. Its end goal is to get rid of them altogether. Whereas we find here most family farms have a deep attachment to their land, have a deep pride in their land, and want to be good stewards of the land that they look after. And I think that connection to place and that love of place are what we build back from. And I think it's true everywhere. I've been to places like Iowa and Indiana, and even some of the farmers in the most conventional industrialized farming systems, even in those farmhouses, even in those families, there's a deep love of the land. And that's, we just have to tweak that. We have to wean it off this model of agriculture, which doesn't work, which is broken. And we need to turn it back to something better. And the rest of us have to help. When we eat in a restaurant, when we buy in a shop, it's partly on us. We have to start asking, how was this produced? Where did it come from? How do I help the good guys? And might that cost a little bit more for our food? Yeah, maybe. And the truth is, most of us can afford that. Not everybody. There's issues there about food poverty. But many of us, I would wager most people listening to this program, can actually devote slightly more of their household budgets to paying for food for it to be produced in the right way rather than the wrong way. And that's on us. We have to do that.
Yeah. Well, you know, my grandfather was a farmer in the American West, very arid conditions. Very difficult to. I have never met a person who worked more than my grandfather. He from before the sun came up till after the sun went down, and then in the middle of the night, sometimes getting the irrigation water to where it has to go. I don't know that he ever slept, and so I'm worried. I'm worried about you, James. I'm worried about your capacity to keep up with it. I think you may have solved some of the pressure problem of farming by sometimes outsourcing what can be done. For instance, you actually paid a botanist to come in and survey what's going on with your plants, because there's no way you have hours in the day to do that kind of survey, that kind of science yourself.
That's totally true. So I forget who it was. Somebody said it takes a village to rear a child. And whoever said that was a genius, because it takes a village to look after a piece of land properly. I've been really, really lucky, or I guess it's lucky, in that I've spent the last 15 years making friends with all sorts of amazing people who can help me on this journey. And you're right, I need a botanist, because a botanist has specialist knowledge about plants that I don't have. And I need a soil scientist. Now, maybe I can't afford a soil scientist, but I can go on YouTube or whatever, and or social media, and I can learn from the soil scientist. And I need somebody who's an expert on maybe plant diversity or bird diversity, or somebody else that can help me with issues about animal health if I start to move my cattle away from needing any kind of antibiotics or ophthalmic wormers or whatever it might be. You're absolutely right. There isn't anybody on earth clever enough to know everything that you need to know to be the perfect steward of a piece of land. I think part of this is really humbling. You realize how limited your own intelligence is and your knowledge is. And that's why this has to be wider than just leaving farmers to produce the cheapest food ever, as if it is a factory floor. It has to be much wider. We have to build communities in which lots of people are engaged in food production. Lots of different disciplines and skills and kinds of knowledge are brought to bear on this. And yeah, and far from that being impossible or horrible or problematic, it's actually been really exciting and fun in our valley, in our community. So we have a lot more people come on our farm than we used to. We have people who come to teach us things, or people that come to learn from us about the things that we know. And it's, instead of our farm feeling stressful and lonely and in a kind of agonizing slow defeat, it feels like a kind of renaissance on this farm and in this valley and in this landscape, because people are taking back control. They're taking back control from really bad sort of corporatized industrialized systems and starting to care about local food again, starting to care about local farmers, starting to work together across those disciplines. And trying to mend this place so that we can look each other in the eye and look anybody else in the eye and say, actually, we're doing okay. We're not perfect, but we're doing okay. And that's a damn sight better than we would be if we weren't thinking about this stuff and we weren't doing something about it and if we weren't working together. It's, yeah.
Oh, well, your valley sounds very lovely, like you have good neighbors, but I wonder if there have ever, in your story, in your journey of farming, have there ever been local naysayers who have thought, well, he's kind of a kook?
There might have been if I was brave or clever enough to be one of the gurus that had started all this off, but I wasn't. I'm a much more conventional conservative with a small c individual and family. So we're very much part of a very, very long farming tradition. And just as I've been talking about the changes on our farm and the changes in our thinking, a lot of that process has been happening to our neighbors and friends. So we all credit to those people who did stand out against the tide and who said this 20 or 30 years ago.
Okay, that's more comfortable, isn't it?
they deserve the credit for standing out and doing the brave bit. I guess I'm in the second wave of much more normal farmers who are saying, okay, this is true and I think we can do it. And go to the pub and talk to my even more conventional farming friends and say, I think there's something in this. Like we could step up and do this better. And far from there being a lot of people saying, no, you're crazy, there are one or two of those people here. But the general consensus here is maybe there's something in this. Okay, there is something in this. Let's get on with it.
Let's
do this.
Well, back to the botanist who did the survey. Can you tell, did the botanist bring you any good plant stories? What did you learn from that survey?
So we thought we'd screwed the farm up worse than we had in the 1980s and 90s. So one of the nice things was when we got him to do a botanical survey, he came back after a couple of days of crawling around the fields and he said, you're not going to believe this, but there's over 200 species of flowers and plants and grasses here, including 14 species that are on the endangered red list in the UK. And some of that stuff I have never seen in my life. Like, I obviously wasn't walking around the fields enough. I wasn't paying attention enough to see these things. But when that guy, Rob, starts showing you these little plants that are growing on your land and which the future of which depends entirely on me and my family's decision-making and management, then that's really exciting. And he's been bringing back, he helped us to plant 6,500 little plug plants of species that were missing. So we've put the things back that were here 100 years ago. And yeah, it's really exciting. And you're talking about naysayers. One of the people in this valley, who's a really good friend of mine, actually runs a business doing the machinery contracting, like the tractors and the combine harvesters and things. But he also does my work, and he works on a lot of the more modern farms 10, 15 miles away. Every single year when he gets off the mower, when he comes to mow the hay, he says the same thing to me. He said, wow, this is just like fields used to be. Look at all these flowers and insects. And he loves it. Now, okay, he hasn't made the next step mentally of saying, why is this better? And maybe I could do it at home. He hasn't made that step yet, but that's okay. He'll get there. But for that guy who cares about tractors and machinery, and that's his job to do that, for that guy every single year to get nostalgic and to see the beauty in it and to admire it and admire what we're doing, I think, wow, we can win here. Who really doesn't like nature? I know a lot of people thoughtlessly destroy nature, but who doesn't want to actually look after it once they understand it? I think that's where this gets interesting, isn't it? And that's why I'm excited as a writer in my first book, Shepherd's Life, and then the second, the Pastoral Song. If I can share some of our story with other people, if I can get people to read these books and think again about their food and their shopping or farming families to think about how they manage their land, then, hey, I'm a tiny part of a big picture of things changing, and there's a thrill in that.
James Rebanks, we haven't talked sheep, and you've got all those Twitter followers and a lot of photos of sheep. I just have to tell you, those are beautiful creatures.
I love been talking about soil and nature and ecological recovery. I'm a shepherd, basically. That's my main job. This is the busiest week of, don't feel bad. This is the busiest week of our shepherding calendar. So yesterday was the first one of the big sheep sales where we sell the tups, the rams, the males, and Saturday's the next one. And literally the minute I stop talking to you, I'm going to go and get my two daughters and we're going to go and wash the legs and the heads of some of the rams, the tups that we sell on Saturday, and we'll keep working on the preparation of them so that we hopefully can go and make good money doing that. And yeah, and that's our focus. Like you asked about what do people locally think about it. The truth is a lot of my farming friends just think I'm a farmer that does the same things as them. I still go to the same sales as them. I still produce the sheep that they produce. On Saturday, I hope to beat them. Nothing helps. Nothing helps your shepherding cred like winning at the big sheep sales. So that's the tradition that meant that we could live in this hard place. That's the way of life that my father and grandfather were part of, and way back for centuries and centuries before them, and it's still part of who we were. And I haven't turned into some crazy hippie. I'm just a farmer who cares about I care about the things we always cared about. But you can't unknow things when you've learned them. And we now know so much about what we've done to nature, how we've degraded our landscapes. The minute you know that, you've got two choices. You can go into some kind of weird denial or reactionary refusal, or you can be big enough to grow up and to start to do something about it. And what I'm seeing all around me is farmers listening to that, learning about it, and all in loads of different ways, responding and saying, okay, we hear you, we see this, what do we do about it? And I barely know any farmers that aren't thinking about this stuff, who aren't starting to do things to put things back together. And I would just urge the rest of you, really, that we're a tiny share of society now, less than 1% of us are farmers. We need the other 99%, or as many of you as possible, to care about this stuff, to reach out to us, to encourage us, to start asking questions in restaurants and cafes and butcher shops and other things like that. We need you to have you on our side, to be asking the questions, to force this through, make this the norm. And yeah, I just hope lots of people listening to this can do their own little bit. Have a conversation as a family or a community. Start to support your local farmers. Maybe get involved in growing something yourselves, or supporting like a CSA, a community supported agriculture scheme, where you can maybe get a veg box or some local meat production. These are really important actions, and you know, we can do it.
James, I appreciate and am inspired by, frankly, your pragmatism and your wisdom and your enthusiasm. It sure comes across on the radio. A pleasure to meet you, and I'll let you go. Take care of those sheep.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on, and hi to all my American friends who might be listening to this.
James Rebanks with us. He runs a family-owned farm in England and is author of Pastoral Song, A Farmer's Journey. Even as James Rebanks struggles to hold on to many of the old traditional practices on his English family farm, there's been a movement underway in many places around the globe, sometimes this movement referred to as rewilding. It turns out that in many instances, it's not nearly as hard to restore large tracts of land to their natural state as you might think. Sometimes all you have to do is let them alone. We're going to hear two such stories on Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Earlier, we were speaking with James Rebanks. He's an English farmer, a sheep herder, and author of an award-winning book titled Pastoral Song. That book chronicles his efforts to keep a family farm close to its roots in England's Lake District. We're going to turn now to a conversation with a kindred spirit. The aptly named Isabella Tree is journalist and author of Wilding, Returning Nature to Our Farm. Her story is one of turning a 3,500-acre family estate into a mini wilderness preserve, and doing this led to remarkable, surprising, and I would even say charming results. Here's a highlight from my conversation with Isabella Tree.
It is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, if you wake up, you know, and it's a lovely dawn morning, and you wake up to surround sound birdsong, it just pulls you outside. 3 days ago, one of our Exmoors gave birth to a foal right outside the house. And we were alerted to this fact because we had five or six of the other Exmoor ponies standing around in a really strange formation, staring at the house. And we couldn't work out what they were doing. And they were guarding the female who was giving birth. It was absolutely extraordinary.
And I probably need to ask what an Exmoor is exactly. That's a breed I haven't heard of before.
Well, it's one of our oldest breeds of horse. So one of the sort of premises of what we've done at NEP is really to introduce some of the animals that would have been proxy, that are proxies for what would have been roaming our landscape in pre-human impact times. So the kind of animals that would have been driving the landscape, driving the habitat creation, that would would have co-evolved with our vegetation, because we're beginning to understand how these animals, the grazing and browsing megafauna, are keystone species in the way that they kickstart natural processes again. So we don't in Europe have the tarpan anymore. This is the sort of the ancestor of the European horse. Obviously, the horse originally came from America across the Bering Strait, but in Europe, it was known as the tarpan, and it became extinct several centuries ago. But we do have domesticated descendants, so breeds of horse that have become feral again, but that are phenotypically very similar to the original tarpan. And the Exmoor pony looks very like the cave paintings in Lascaux in France that are 17,500 years old. It's short and stocky. It's got this amazing ice tail. It's got eyes that it can kind of glaze over with a kind of protective layer of fat to kind of help protect it against ice flows, and I suppose from the claws of predators. So it's a very kind of primeval looking horse. And we really have introduced it onto our project to mimic the disturbance that these kind of horses would have created in the landscape thousands of years ago.
And that disturbance goes beyond just defecation, their excrement. That's important, I would imagine, to drive things along. What else do they do that's so important?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. The dung is hugely important, and having sort of organic dung in the landscape, you know, and all the other insects that that feed and breed in dung, you know, the dung beetle is just as one example that pull that dung back into the soil. So that's a hugely important process of how to reignite the soil fertility. But they're also browsing and grazing in different ways, all these animals. So they have different preferences. They will take the bark off branches and twigs, for example. They'll self-medicate, take particular interest in certain herbs at different times of year if they want to boost their iron or mineral reserves. But there's some very interesting sort of relationship between equines and bovines, and that we're also just beginning to understand. Princeton University has been doing a project in Kenya, and it's very counterintuitive what they've discovered, but it's so much like so much of rewilding is counterintuitive in a way. But what they've discovered is that if you have 100 head of cattle grazing a certain area, they put on more condition, more weight, if they're allowed to graze with equines. So those equines could be a donkey, they could be ponies, they could even be zebra. But they'll put on more condition if they're grazing alongside them. And you'd think, well, surely they're competing for the same resources, but that's not the case at all. What happens is that the equines take out the really rough stuff, all the really tough fibrous grasses and the thistles and things that cows can't stomach. And that enables the sweeter, softer grasses to come up underneath that the cattle then benefit from, that they then enables them to put on weight. So I have this kind of rather sort of fanciful idea, I don't know, image in my head of how in the past you would have had herds of tarpan wandering through our landscape, and behind them you would have had herds of aurochs, the ancient cow, trailing in its wake, benefiting from the habitat that the horses had created for them.
You have been discovering so many relationships between living things, and this is just one example of that. I hope we have a chance to get into that a little bit more in just a bit. First, I want to go back to the very beginning of the decision that you and Charlie made to abandon the farm, as it were, not to leave the site, but to abandon farming. Could you relate how that came about and how this concept of rewilding entered into your own personal experience?
Yes, I mean, you know, we inherited this farm. It's 3,500 acres from Charlie's grandparents in the 1980s. And it was an intensive arable and dairy farm. We assumed when we took it over that that was going to be what we were doing, going to be doing for the rest of our lives. It was already a loss-making farm when we took over, and we assumed, I suppose, with the with the sort of arrogance of youth, that it was really down to his grandparents' mismanagement of the farm. They hadn't invested in infrastructure. They didn't know the latest technologies. And we thought we could turn the fortunes of the farm around. And so for 17 years, you know, we did what every good farmer is supposed to do. We invested in bigger machinery. We invested in infrastructure, made efficiencies. We diversified into ice cream and yogurt. We did everything we could think of to improve the fortunes of the farm. And of course, we put more and more chemicals on the land. We put more fertilizer, more pesticides, more fungicides, more herbicides, everything we could possibly do to increase the crop yields. But what we found was that after 17 years, we were still losing money, more than ever before. And the reason was we're on very, very heavy clay soil. It's just not cut out for industrial modern farming. We sit on 320 meters of this stuff. And in the winter, it's like porridge. And in the summer, it's as hard as concrete. You can literally put your whole arm up to your shoulder into a crack. It's just absolutely unforgiving stuff. And so we realized that we were just, you know, we could never compete with farms on better soil. But selling for us wasn't an option, really. We you know, this estate has been in the family for over 250 years. We realized we just wanted to do something that was going to work with the land rather than battling against it all the time. And we have always, Charlie, my husband and I, had a kind of amateurish love for nature. We've always have traveled the world to look at nature. I used to be a travel correspondent. And he grew up, my husband grew up in Africa and in Australia. And we never really once thought about the wildlife we could have in our own backyard. And it wasn't until we met this Dutch ecologist who had been doing some amazing experiments in rewilding on the continent in the Netherlands. And he really showed us how free-roaming herbivores, these, you know, large megafauna, can kickstart natural processes on even the most depleted land. They are the sort of the trigger, the sort of dynamism that can lift the glider back up into the sky so it can fly again, if you like. And the way they disturb the land, the way they trample and rootle and dung and their different vegetation preferences, all of these things recreate and generate habitats and in a kind of very dynamic way, a kind of kaleidoscope of habitats. So we just thought, wouldn't it be amazing to experiment and see if we could do this, if we could get life back onto our severely depleted post-agricultural land in the southeast of England, surrounded by conurbation and underneath the Gatwick stacking system, then we could prove a point that you could bring back nature anywhere.
That's the voice of Isabella Tree. She's the author of Wilding, Returning Nature to Our Farm. Had a great conversation with her, and you can listen to it back from our website at any time. And but next, I really want to have you listen to something that is related to what she had to say, and bring all of that to bear on this next closely related conversation we had with a 91-year-old Texas rancher, David Bamberger, who turned his family's 5,500-acre ranch into a nature preserve. And as he did that, it dramatically altered things. It altered the ecology. It created home for endangered species. It even brought lost springs back to life, bringing much-needed water to very arid country. He's a man of great vision and spirit and conviction and energy. Here is some of what David Bamberger offered us here on Constant Wonder.
I drilled 7 wells, water wells, 500 foot deep, but did not get a drop of water. After that, we began a plan of habitat restoration. That had to do with the removal of a lot of woody species that had taken over due to poor land management. When we removed a lot of that and replaced it with native grass seed, and the grass took a hold, putting root systems down in. 2.5 years after we got that process rolling, the first spring developed. And we ended up with that one spring being able to pipe water from a hillside, which was actually almost 2.5 miles away from our home, and got that water coming into our house with no pumps, no motors, just gravity flow out of these hills. Since that time, and the continual work that we have been on for years and is still going on, there have been 10 other springs come to life. And we now have 5 families who these springs supply water to, with no pumps, no motors. It's all gravity flow. And that's 5 families that now have water to drink, to bathe. They have for cooking and also for any livestock. And for quite some time, I had up at one time as many as 200 mother cows. But we've scaled that back dramatically because we have continuous droughts going on in Texas, and we're in the middle of one right now that's very serious.
Well, how would this change come about with a simple alteration of the landscape by putting grasses in?
In our particular case, the geologists that come out to look, they said, all of these springs you have, Mr. Bamberger, they're all, if you've ever thought about it, they're all at 125 foot off the tops of these hills. That puts them at almost 1,900 foot above sea level. At the same time, these geologists said, the root systems, this grass, going down, allow rainfall now instead of running off to drift in because of the root systems of grass. And they began to make what we call, as geologists, perched or local aquifers. And all of your hilltops on this ranch, Mr. B, they're all on top or set on top of these perched aquifers. Generally speaking, there's not enough water in these aquifers for developers to build a whole bunch of homes or something. But all of these rainfalls you're getting, I'll move back a bit because the driller that drilled those 7 dry holes for me, he said my bit dropped 40 foot on top of one of your hills. He said, you have a cave under there. It's just full of air, but not water. Well, the 2.5 years time when the root systems of the grass and the root systems of grass can reach down into these perched aquifers, and it filled up that giant auditorium that the driller said. He said, I had to put on a new piece of drill stem. My bit dropped 40 foot. Tried and tried to get into that. We never could. But after 2.5 years, that big auditorium underground filled with water because of the root systems of grass. And I'm here to pledge. I'm here to tell you, I preach this, that grass is the greatest conservation tool that ever existed. And too many landowners historically overgrazed, not just from the eating up all the grass, but also hoof action pounded the soil. And that allowed the woody species that most animals don't eat. It allowed them to take over. And when we eliminated most of that by cutting it out, digging it out, or whatever, I don't use chemicals, I don't really believe in them, all of this worked almost like miracles. And so the thing I preach the gospel of conservation by using grass.
Now, the grasses are able to grow better, number one, because of a reduction in the cattle on the property, but also because the woody species don't shade them out?
It's all because of, in our particular case, we couldn't have cattle at that time because we're trying to get these grasses established. And if you move livestock in on young grasses, man, it's like candy. They go right to it. And they won't allow it to grow. And when you look at grasses, whatever you see above the ground in a grass, you can generally speak in some species, you can multiply that by 6 or 7. The root system is that much bigger than what you see on top. So if a cow comes along, or if you went back in history, a buffalo, But see, the buffalo move. Cattle don't move because they're now raised and they generate income. And so the cattle are contained by fences. We removed all of those and got the grass and gave it a chance to build the root system. That's when the rains hit. Instead of go pouring off the land. Oh, we did some other things, too, I'd love to tell you about. But that was the main thing.
The real driver of the change in the water.
That was the real driver, yes. Yeah.
Well, the water is one remarkable story. There are so many stories on your ranch. Talk about the birds.
Oh, I just love this story. I've always loved birds. When I came here 50 years ago, I asked the Parks and Wildlife Department and all the Audubon societies around me, some in Austin, Texas, some in San Antonio. They came all year at three and four times a year and did bird counts. When I first began this project, they recorded only 48 bird species on year-around bird counts. Every year, every single year I could... I have charts, and I kept measuring it, and they kept coming back. And as this grass began to grow, voila, the next thing you know, we have 62 bird species. And as it grew, we next thing we know, have 91. And every year, we seem even yet to pick up another species. Our last bird count was 218 species from 48 that took place 50 years ago.
David Bamberger is the founder of the Bamberger Ranch Preserve. He was born in 1928. When we checked last, he was still chugging right along. I'm Marcus Smith. You're listening to Constant Wonder. Tomorrow, we're going to bring you quite a story. It comes from France, and it has to do with honey. Honey of the wrong color, actually. Honey that turned blue or green. And farmers didn't know what was going on with the honey. Turns out that they were actually a little bit too close to an M&M candy factory, and some of the dyes were left out in the open, sugary waste products from making the candy. And who found them? The honeybees found them. All of this in a story about the interconnectedness of different life forms, how we and insects and birds and mammals and plants all are connected together. It's called Tapestries of Life. We hope you can join with us tomorrow for more Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Our show is a production of BYU Radio.